Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Local New York lawmakers are urging Governor Kathy Hochul to sign legislation streamlining the recertification process for a program that centers on minority and women-owned businesses in the construction industry. The Legislative Gazette's Sajina Shrestha has more.
The Minority and Women-Owned Business Enterprise Certification Program is a statewide program that expands business opportunities for minority and women business owners. Contractors on a state-funded project are required by New York State regulation to meet a 30% MWBE participation goal. As a result, chances to win bids for public work jobs improve for subcontractors certified as MWBE. The MWBE certificate is highly beneficial and is valid for 5 years upon receipt. However, according to local lawmakers, the recertification process for this program has become vague and confusing, costing business owners time and money. According to the state senator, Michelle Hinchey, the recertification process has not just become tedious, but also degrading.
It's also just, quite frankly, pretty demeaning, especially for our women business owners, at least from what we heard here, of people within the system questioning their qualifications, questioning if they could possibly know how to run a general contracting firm or know anything about the construction industry, for example. That's ludicrous. And we shouldn't be putting our small businesses through that.
Hinchey recently attended a roundtable discussion about the recertification process at the Capital Region Chamber of Commerce. One of the panelists was Elisa Cal Henderson, president of Duncan & Cal Incorporated in Troy. Her company is a general contractor that first became MWBE certified in 2010. This certification opened doors for the company, helping them work on multi-million dollar state projects, taking on smaller chunks of the contract to install parts of the project. Seeing this as a benefit, Henderson recertified in 2013 and 2017. However, when time came for Henderson's company to recertify in 2021, she ran into roadblocks and barriers that cost her a total of $6,000. Her latest recertification process, after the certificate was extended from 3 years to five, included confusing questions.
The recertification process, we filled everything out like we usually do, it was probably a year's worth of questions, you know. What jobs, I had to give them all the requisitions from the jobs that I ran. I had to send in things I had signed. I mean, it was minuscule, sort of crazy stuff. I was running this company. Never had a phone call, never had a question, never had anybody visit, but just these questions. So the questions started to get, more vague, more, I didn't know what they were searching for.
Not understanding the purpose of the questions, Henderson went to her attorney, who helped her file for recertification. After a year of answering questions and filling out every document, Henderson's request for recertification was denied. When she and her lawyer appealed the denial, the process got even more confusing.
So then I went back to the lawyer, and we had to appeal within 30 days. I mean, the first letter, the dates didn't match when I had to get in, so I called. I got a solid date I had to have it in by. She applied for the appeal. Then you have to apply for a FOIL to get all the information that they have back. I asked for a virtual interview rather than a recertification by or an appeal by paper. So I asked for a virtual, but I was never asked to attend a virtual, and then I received my recertification.
After an additional 9 months of this process, Henderson was finally recertified again. According to lawmakers, Henderson's story is not the outlier, it is the norm. Business owners often spend time and money outside of their daily work to apply, answer, and appeal for their recertification. Citing these hassles, Hinchey and Assemblymember John McDonald introduced a bill streamlining the recertification process. The bill, which passed both the State Senate and the State Assembly, now awaits Governor Hochul's signature and would make it easier for businesses to become recertified if there has been no change in ownership or material change in management. McDonald's said this new process, which would make it easier by automatically recertifying qualifying businesses, is a productive way for the state to make sure its goals are being met.
We think it makes perfect sense because, quite honestly, the state has set some very high goals for minority and women-owned business participation. Sometimes 25-30% of the job. The state needs these firms to be active and engaged and working and doing a public work. And it's kind of self-defeating when you have one agency of the state basically putting these longtime businesses in a purgatory where they really don't know their status.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Sajina Shrestha.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Welcome back to the Legislative Gazette. Well, last week we heard from Corinne Carey, the Senior Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey, who are pushing to pass what they call the Medical Aid and Dying Act. And the fact is that their side was heard, but we haven't heard from the other side yet. And to that end, joining us now is Jessica Rogers. She is the Coalition's Director for the Patients' Rights Action Fund, a national, secular, nonprofit, nonpartisan group defending the rights of patients, people with disabilities, our elders, they say, and the poor from the threat of legalized assisted suicide. First, welcome to the Legislative Gazette, Jessica Rogers.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think we can see right from the beginning, and I mentioned this to Corinne Carey, Jessica, that the language is different from both sides. So you guys say assisted suicide, they say medical aid in dying or the Death with Dignity Act. And, you know, that's a real difference in how you feel about this. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved with this organization, and tell our listeners what your group is trying to do, what they represent when it comes to this issue.
Absolutely. The Patients' Rights Action Fund, as you noted, is a national organization that works with our very diverse coalition partners around the country who see the significant risks that these policies pose, particularly for the disability community and for those living in poverty. Me personally, I got involved in this because I grew up in a state where it was legal. I was a caregiver for my mother, who had a terminal illness and qualified for the law, and I witnessed firsthand the erosion of trust that happens between a patient and a doctor when suddenly your doctor prescribing you lethal drugs to end your life is a viable option on the table. And then as I learned more about the issue and continue to see the really terrible abuses of these laws that continue to happen in the states where it's legal, it became pretty clear that as a social worker, particularly one who focused in gerontology and aging, that this was an issue I needed to be involved in to stand up and work to protect our most vulnerable neighbors.
Yeah, and we should tell everyone that medical aid in dying, or as you might say, assisted suicide, is legal in 11 states and the District of Columbia. That includes California, Colorado, Delaware, Hawaii, Montana, in our region of the Northeast, Maine and New Jersey, Vermont, New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington, D.C., as was mentioned in the beginning. But that's quite a few states, and we've even seen people going to other states to have this procedure done. When you talk about the dangers here, can you give us some specific examples, Jessica?
Absolutely. Most recently in the news was the story of Jane Allen, a young woman in her 20s in Colorado. She had she had anorexia, which is a mental health condition, and she was abandoned by her doctor. She was given lethal drugs to end her life. She thankfully had her father step in. He destroyed the drugs, and she was able to go on and get the actual help that she needed to recover from her anorexia. But her doctor, under this policy, was able to legally abandon her and give her drugs to end her life. That's not the only instance of anorexia being a qualifying condition. And there have never been any sanctions on the physician for prescribing to her for her mental health condition.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is that one of the conditions in the New York law? Because what I'm reading here is that in New York, the legislation would allow terminally ill and mentally competent adults with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live to request lethal medication. So that's a little different than just someone with anorexia, isn't it?
Well, that's what you would think, right? And that's why this policy is so insidious. The New York language mirrors the Colorado language under which Jane Allen was prescribed these drugs. So the key here is that treatment is never required. So if you have a condition that could become terminal or is terminal if you don't have treatment or you can't access treatment and can't afford treatment, or if you refuse treatment, then under the law, you are considered to have a terminal condition. So in New York, young women with anorexia, just like in Colorado, would qualify for assisted suicide. And that is an issue with the language. The language is the same between these laws. We've seen case studies out of Oregon. Again, the same language of a six-month diagnosis, terminal condition, of people with non-terminal conditions who choose to stop eating and drinking and find a prescriber who says, well, you have the intention to not eat or drink, therefore you're terminal, even though the underlying condition does not meet that 6 months criteria. And then they go ahead and they prescribe lethal drugs, and the person ends their life legally with the sanction of the state. So this is a very broad policy. However, you know, the proponents like to say that it's tight language, but it really is quite broad because treatment is never required within the law.
We're speaking with Jessica Rogers. She is the Coalition's Director for the Patients' Rights Action Fund. This is a national, secular, nonpartisan, nonprofit group that's defending the rights of patients, people with disabilities, elders, and the poor from what they call the threat of legalized assisted suicide. Let me go into another area that's often brought up. And that is, and I notice in your language, you say you're secular, so it's not religious. Your arguments are not religious. But if they're not religious, I'm wondering if there are any conditions, you know, tighter language, for example, you say it's too broad now. Are there any conditions in which the group would say, okay, this law makes sense? It really does narrow its focus to people who are truly terminally ill and may end up in severe pain and drugged up and not having a quality end of life.
You know, if that kind of language exists, it certainly hasn't been proposed in any of the states that consider it. And you mentioned, David, the list of states that have passed this legislation. I think it's important to note for your listeners that this is not a popular bill. You know, this last year alone, it was introduced in 18 states. I think it was introduced in 20 last year. And that's pretty consistent. You know, there's a push in a lot of states every single year. And every few years, one of them does pass it. So this has been a push over, you know, 30 years since Oregon first legalized it. That's not what I personally would consider popular legislation, because politicians, it doesn't matter red or blue, recognize the unique dangers that this type of policy poses. You know, we can look at the data out of Oregon. We can see that pain, including the fear of future pain, has never been a top five reason that people request these drugs. And we also see that over the last few years, a growing percentage of people are self-reporting financial implications of treatment as a reason for their request to end their life. Especially in this climate right now, where we have people that are worried about basic healthcare costs, they're worried about how they're putting food on the table next week. And when healthcare is so expensive and inaccessible for so many people, this suddenly becomes the cheaper option. 30 years of data in Oregon shows clearly that this isn't about pain. It's about not having supports for living. And now we have a government policy that is sanctioning assisted suicide for some people and not for others, which creates a two-tier system. It creates a different level of care for some individuals than for others.
Isn't it all contained in the two-tier system of haves and have-nots? I mean, that's what you're describing right now. I tend to agree with you that we do not have an equitable healthcare system in this country, and that's the real problem.
Absolutely. No, I mean, no argument from me there. So in that environment, why would you introduce a policy that allows physicians to actively help some patients and their life? I mean, that is the government making a value judgment about some lives over others.
Well, and so then comes the question that I asked Corinne, and I'm going to ask you. You know, the governor, Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, both houses of the legislature have passed this bill, which has been in the works for a decade, but the governor is holding it close to the vest. My prediction is she's not going to sign the bill. I wonder where you are.
Well, I know that she's hearing from physicians. She's hearing from members of the disability community. She's hearing from everyday people who have walked this road themselves or with loved ones who are asking her to please veto this dangerous legislation. And, you know, she came down and said that she'll make the right decision. I think that the right decision for all New Yorkers is to veto this legislation. This was not particularly popular within her own party. I think, you know, anyone who watches Albany probably is aware of how tight that margin was, particularly in the assembly. This was not a bill without controversy. And I wouldn't be surprised if she stands up and says, this is the wrong bill for New York. And, you know, the New York bill, for what, you know, all of these bills are really terrible and dangerous. But the New York bill in particular strips away some of the framework that we see in other states. There is no waiting period in this bill, and there's no residency requirement in this bill. It encourages people to come from out of state to meet with a doctor, potentially over telehealth, because there's no in-person requirement, with a physician that they've never seen, that they have no pre-existing relationship with, and that day receive drugs to end their life. And then after that, and this is key, I don't think people realize there's no oversight after that happens. You know, these drugs are dispensed. People occasionally hold on to them for years. We've seen that happen. And there's absolutely no oversight after those drugs are delivered to the patient. So we don't know if that patient retains capacity. We don't know if they take it of their own free will. There's no follow-up. And the only reporting that happens from the state is what an individual who potentially was with the person at the end of their life chooses to report to the state. If you look at these state reports, you'll see a large portion of patients, the information is simply unknown. Did they have complications? Unknown. In the cases that we do know about, within the last couple of years, we know patients have taken as long as 5.5 days to die after taking these drugs. So this promised, you know, peaceful, no complications is simply not reality when you look at the data reported by the state.
Now, let's just say for a moment that the law does get signed by Governor Hochul. We have it in these other 11 states as well, in the District of Columbia. Does your organization work on any level to repeal? I mean, are you also working on campaigns in that regard because of your opposition?
Absolutely. We've been pleased to partner with national and statewide disability justice organizations that have sued both the states of California and Colorado to repeal their bills. And that's currently making their way through the courts.
Jessica Rogers, the coalition's director for the Patients' Rights Action Fund. It's a national, secular, nonpartisan, nonprofit group that defends the rights of patients, people with disabilities, elders, and the poor from what they call the threat of legalized assisted suicide. Jessica Rogers, thank you so much for joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A small town in the eastern Adirondacks has become an unexpected home for military exercises. A man from Virginia is doing contract work for the U.S. military on land he owns in the town of Lewis. Now he wants to build the shooting range for military-grade cannons. Some locals and a top Green group are pushing back. The New York Public News Network's Emily Russell has the report.
The Essex County town of Lewis is home to about 1,300 people. It's just up the road from Elizabethtown and a few miles east of the Jay Mountain Wilderness.
We moved here and live here because of the quality of life. It's a quiet, small town.
That's Lenita Canavan. She grew up in Lewis and now serves on the town board. In mid-September, Canavan's phone started ringing off the hook. Folks were wondering why military helicopters were flying low over town.
I've got neighbors wanting to know, you know, are we under attack? You know, we've got people with PTSD that are being affected by the noise.
The helicopters were part of a military exercise known as Jaded Thunder. It took place over a two-week span in September and was overseen by Michael Hopmeyer. He's an engineer based in Virginia and owns about 380 acres of land in Lewis. He's spent his career doing contract work for the military. A lot of locals in Lewis were caught off guard by Jaded Thunder, so Hopmeyer scheduled a town meeting a few weeks later. He spoke to a room of about 75 people.
People who were participating in that exercise were active duty military. They were active duty Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps.
This is audio from WCAX.
They were also foreign units, again, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, who were here training to try and meet certain standards.
Hopmeyer declined to be interviewed for this story, but did speak to NCPR on background. He says he's hosted hundreds of military experiments and exercises in Lewis over the last decade. Everything from small-scale drone tests to one training that involved more than 200 people. It may seem strange that a private citizen is hosting military exercises on private land in the Adirondacks, but the town of Lewis doesn't have any zoning laws in place to regulate how people use their private property. Town Supervisor Jim Monty explained that fact to the folks at the meeting back in September.
That'd be no different than me telling what you can do on your property because we don't have the local laws or the zoning.
But the Adirondack Park Agency does have laws regulating certain uses of private property. In 2021, Hopmeyer submitted a permit application to the APA to add a weapons range in Lewis. Specifically, he wants to study the internal ballistics of a 155mm howitzer, which is kind of like a modern-day cannon.
Fire!
This is video footage of U.S. Marines firing off howitzers last year. When Hopmeyer first applied for an APA permit, nearly all the public commenters opposed the project. Emma Jean Okuski was against it back then and is still against it today.
When this blasting starts, how do we know that that's not going to split our foundations on our houses? Or how do we know that those pollutants aren't going in our wells?
Hopmeyer said he chose the location of the weapons range in part because of the natural sound barrier of the sloped property. In his communication with the APA over the years, Hopmeyer has said the sound from the weapons range won't be louder than the blasting noise at the local mine in Lewis. And he said he won't be using any lead or potential contaminants at the range. The plan is to shoot solid steel ammunition into a cargo container filled with sand. If the APA approves his permit, Hopmeyer will be allowed to shoot up to 30 times per year on weekdays between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. While most public comments on Hopmeyer's initial application were negative, some folks were and still are in favor of it.
It has to be done somewhere, so why not here?
That's Ben Pocon. He's a forester in Lewis who's done some work for Hopmeyer, though Pocon submitted his public comment before that work. Pocon doesn't think he'll be bothered by the weapons range. He believes the local mine is noisier than the range will be. Plus, Pocon says he's pro-business.
If there is someone locally who is bringing new enterprise to the area, I am generally going to be supportive of that.
The Adirondack Park Agency is expected to review Hopmeyer's permit at the next board meeting. Rocky Aguirre, who leads the Adirondack Council, says he thinks the project deserves deep scrutiny.
The potential for negative change is significant here, and unless we can be convinced otherwise, it's doesn't feel like the right fit for Lewis or the immediate vicinity.
But the APA board can't just deny a permit. Before doing that, the project would need to go to an adjudicatory hearing. It's a public forum overseen by a judge where both parties present evidence and arguments. The APA hasn't held an adjudicatory hearing in more than a decade, but Aguirre says this project is unprecedented here in the park and thinks it's controversial enough that it warrants a hearing.
Our core concern is that without an adjudicatory hearing, we won't get the science and technical expertise to be brought into this process that would help inform the APA staff and board.
The Adirondack Park Agency is accepting public comment on the project through this Thursday, and it's expected to review the permit at its board meeting on November 13th. In the Adirondacks, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2544. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.